heard many, many fantastic opportunities and tools, many of which, you know, are designed to resonate with African American communities and can also be used with among other populations more broadly. So now I'm happy to tell you about another tool that Ms. Katsusa mentioned, our Viral Hepatitis Action Plan. When you go to APHA's website, you can download all of the handouts for this presentation, including the forum report that she mentioned, as well as the two-pager on our action plan, and we have that available for you as well at the front. I have no relationships to disclose either. So I want to start by telling you a little bit about the most recent evolution of our national response in the last 5 years. As you've heard from our speakers, there are many challenges around viral hepatitis, in particular that most people are estimated to be unaware of their infection, and also that many clinicians are unaware of the epidemic, and even when they diagnose patients, they may think that the virus is benign. So for these reasons and many others, viral hepatitis is known as the silent epidemic. So that's why it's especially important that in 2010, the Institute of Medicine issued a report that helped break the silence around viral hepatitis. The report accomplished, I think, at least three things. First, it made it very clear that viral hepatitis is the leading cause of liver cancer in the U.S. While it's an underappreciated public health problem, it is a very serious public health problem. IOM also highlighted the lack of awareness across several groups, from the general public to providers and to policymakers. And finally, the IOM expert panel offered many recommendations organized around four areas. So this report, Hepatitis and Liver Cancer by the Institute of Medicine, served as a foundation for what became the first ever national viral hepatitis action plan. So in response, there was a federal committee convened at HHS who very quickly developed this report in 2011. And we are pleased that in 2014, just this past year, we released the updated action plan for 2014 through 2016. So fully implemented, the action plan will increase the proportion of people aware of their hepatitis B infection from 33% to 66%, will increase the proportion of people aware of their hepatitis C infection from 45% to 66%, will reduce the number of new hepatitis C infections by 25%, and eliminate mother-to-child hepatitis B transmission. So we are especially thankful to have all of you here today, as we certainly value the role of our stakeholders, and we look forward to working with more of you. So with our updated plan, we knew that the national goals cannot be achieved through federal action alone, and what we need to achieve these goals is active involvement and innovation from many diverse stakeholders, advocates, and leaders from many different sectors. So the updated plan provides a framework and focus for all stakeholders working in any setting to come together and strengthen the nation's response to viral hepatitis. So as I mentioned, another handout that we have is the Stakeholders Workbook. Again, that's available online, and we encourage all of you to take a look and see how you can use this tool. This is a framework that works on any level, from a large organization to individuals. It offers discussion questions, it has a sample planning toolkit, and there's really something for everyone with specific opportunities at every level, from individuals to the public health community, whether you're in a school of public health, a medical provider, a nursing student, if you're a member of a professional organization or medical association. There are specific opportunities that you can join in. Also, opportunities for community-based providers, patient advocacy groups, really wherever you're working within public health. This is such a cross-cutting epidemic, from cancer prevention, infectious disease, mental health, community health, We look forward to working with you. And in addition to being on the APHA website, this tool is also available on aids.gov/hepatitis. So now I'm pleased to introduce my colleague, Karina Dan, who is the Viral Hepatitis Policy Advisor in the Office of HIV/AIDS and Infectious Disease Policy, OHADIP. She works to implement the National Viral Hepatitis Action Plan and supports coordination of viral hepatitis activities across federal agencies and the community. Previously, Karina served as the Hepatitis B Policy Fellow, the Association of Asian Pacific Community Health Organizations, and as Hepatitis C Virus Program Coordinator at the Chicago Department of Public Health. She is a public health nurse with a master's degree in public health from the University of Illinois here in Chicago.
Thank you so much, Michelle, and Scott and Sonseri as well. You all have set the stage beautifully. Because my role right now is really to try and connect the dots and give you some real ideas of what can be done, what our priorities are at HHS, but then hopefully take home with you some great ideas about how to implement and integrate hepatitis into your work, looking at what those challenges and opportunities are. So I am a public health nurse with a passion for prevention and for strengthening our national response to this issue. And I started working on this issue in 2001, and back then I thought to myself that, there's, in comparison with HIV or breast cancer or so many other health issues, there's so little awareness about hepatitis C. There are so few resources that it almost didn't at that time seem like we were taking hepatitis C seriously. And I wondered to myself when it would happen. When would we start taking hepatitis C seriously? At that time, pegylated interferon had just been released, and I thought, well, maybe when we have a more effective treatment for hepatitis C. Or maybe when we have better screening recommendations for hepatitis C, because at that time the CDC's recommendations were different from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. Maybe that's when it'll start to happen. Or maybe when we see more people dying of hepatitis C, that then we'll really take it seriously. Or more people getting infected with hepatitis C, maybe that's the time. Well, that time is now. We have all of those things coming together, and I think that we have a real opportunity with hepatitis C here in the United States today. So I, too, have no relationships to disclose. So what are we focused on at the Department of Health and Human Services? I would like to talk a little bit about improving the hepatitis C continuum of care in more detail than Dr. Holmberg did. Integrating viral hepatitis, HIV, and substance use prevention program activities, since we know that our new infections are primarily due to the to people who inject drugs and is really going along in tandem with the prescription opioid epidemic in the United States, and then looking at how we can foster partnerships and support collaborations and some shared resources that we may be able to use. So Scott showed a slide. This is a sort of different meta-analysis of what the stages of the hepatitis C continuum of care in the United States, but we really are focused on that 50% of people who are undiagnosed living with hepatitis C, and really a huge missed opportunity in the United States, like 1.6 million missed opportunities, right, at least. And then the fact that overall we only have about 9% of people who had chronic hepatitis C who've been cured of their infection. So those new screening recommendations that are in alignment, we have agreement that we want to screen everyone born from 1945 to 1965 at least once for hepatitis C. And we will be able, just by doing that one thing, to diagnose 75% of people who are living with chronic hepatitis C. When you go look at those risk-based screening recommendations, the first one it's bigger than all the others because it's more prevalent than all the others. Are people who are injecting drugs and getting newly infected with hepatitis C. So there, we've got both people, you know, older individuals who need to be screened, but as well, there's this huge prevention opportunity. There's an early intervention opportunity that we need to seize now. And of course, there are a lot of other. I mean, I'm not trying to say that hepatitis C screening is not a little bit more complicated than just those two groups, but we have opportunities there, even if we only focused on the top two. Of course, individuals with HIV infection are recommended to be tested for hepatitis C as standard of care. And there's also routine testing for hepatitis C recommended for HIV-positive men who have sex with men, where we've seen an increase in new hepatitis C infections in that population as well. But I'd like to remind folks, hopefully you all know this, so I hope I'm preaching to the choir, but hepatitis C testing is a two-step process, right? Unlike with HIV, where 100% of people who become infected with HIV go on to develop a chronic HIV infection, with hepatitis C, 15 to 25% of people who are infected resolve that infection naturally, their bodies naturally fight it off. So some people who test positive for the antibody for hepatitis C are actually virus-free, even though the antibody persists. And so we really need to go that next step, and I think Scott pointed it out on the continuum that he showed, that only about half of people who have had an antibody test are actually confirmed. Sometimes they're told their result and that they have hepatitis C, so they have this kind of incomplete diagnosis, and sometimes they're not even provided with the result of their test. So we have a lot of work to do in terms of getting people their results and getting that confirmation of current infection with the hepatitis C RNA. And Scott's branch or division of viral hepatitis recently put out this new algorithm, which is available at cdc.gov/hepatitis. So it is true that there are some priority groups that are recommended to receive treatment first in the case if there are limited resources. And we know there are limited resources, but the fact is that treatment is recommended by the experts, by the American Association for the Study of Liver Disease, by the Infectious Disease Society of America. It's recommended for all patients with chronic hepatitis C infection, unless they may die it very, very shortly. So the other thing that the experts say is that injection drug use should not be used as a contraindication to hepatitis C therapy. And earlier, I know Scott showed us the map of restrictions that are being put on access to hepatitis C therapy. Those are, in fact, not what the experts recommend. They recommend that all patients with chronic hepatitis C be considered for hepatitis C treatment. So those Affordable Care Act opportunities, one thing that hasn't been mentioned yet is that one of the reasons that there were so many people with chronic hepatitis C who had been uninsured is because there were pre-existing condition exemptions. And insurance companies, prior to the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, were able to say, oh, you have a pre-existing condition. We won't give you health insurance. With the implementation of the Affordable Care Act now, we've gotten rid of those pre-existing condition restrictions. There are, in most places, many places at least, expanded access to health insurance. And so more people than ever before are now covered by health insurance. And of course, the preventive services that are available include both screening for hepatitis B and hepatitis C, but also vaccination for hepatitis A and B. And that vaccination, those are extremely safe and extremely effective prevention tools. They're also, under the ACA, recommended for anyone seeking immunity, right? They're recommended, of course, for everybody at risk, but they're recommended for anyone who wants to be protected against hepatitis A and B. And I would encourage you all to think about how you can help to get more people vaccinated for hepatitis A and B, because we have the tools to prevent them. But of course also screen for hepatitis B and hepatitis C. Because once we test them and we know that individuals are chronically infected with hepatitis C, they are on a path toward accessing hepatitis C treatment and getting cured. Before the new therapies were available, we could put people on a path to getting treatment, but we couldn't assure that they would be cured to the extent that we can now. Of course, nothing's ever 100%, but I've attended the liver meetings a couple of years running, and it's remarkable. When you go to see what the clinical trials on the new hepatitis C treatments are looking like, the bar graphs are like at 90%, 95%, 97% cure rates for all patients who are taking these new drugs, and there are even better drugs currently in development. Dr. Holmberg mentioned that they're combining some of the currently existing treatments to get better outcomes in other countries. We can cure people so that they don't get sicker and die of their hepatitis C treatment. So in this large study, they found a 50% reduction in mortality rates among people who had been cured of their hepatitis C. And that was among generally healthy people. When they looked just at people who already had some liver disease, already had cirrhosis, they saw 75% reduction in mortality, of even higher reduction in people who were co-infected with HIV and hepatitis C. So there are a lot of great reasons to treat people and cure them of their hepatitis C. We can save lives, we can help people live a higher quality of life as well. Because those new therapies are cost effective. You know, the fact is that a lot has changed since those headlines of the $1,000 pill, although we still see some of those headlines. But a lot has changed about the cost and the access to hepatitis C treatment, but it's moving so quickly that we don't know the true story. We don't know the true cost of those medications. That kind of thing isn't readily available. And we really need to shift the discussion away from that $1,000 a pill discussion to, you know, what the actual cost is to insurers and health plans that are covering it, as well as that cost effectiveness, where we see that people are, you know, consuming less healthcare services once they're cured, less likely to die once they're cured. We can do a lot, but we do need to continue to track this. This is a very important issue, and we at HHS are certainly very concerned about it as well. So we have these intersecting epidemics of HIV, viral hepatitis, substance use. Among individuals co-infected with HIV in the United States, about 25% are co-infected with hepatitis C. But when we look at that cohort of 25%, it's actually 80% of people who contracted HIV through injecting drugs are co-infected with hepatitis C, and that's along the lines of what we saw in the Indiana HIV outbreak with 80 to 90% of people in that investigation co-infected with hepatitis C. An additional 10% are co-infected with hepatitis B. Again, we have a safe and effective vaccine for hepatitis B. Because HIV, hepatitis B, and hepatitis C share modes of transmission, they affect the same vulnerable populations, and those prevention opportunities that we often miss to educate individuals who are at risk for HIV about hepatitis. I mean, let's face it, awareness of hepatitis C is incredibly low, and when we miss an opportunity, we're missing an opportunity for people to, you know, understand what their risks are, potentially prevent transmission, so many missed opportunities. Get vaccinated for hepatitis C, and then access drug treatment and sterile injection equipment as well for people who inject drugs. So those health disparities are affecting many of the same communities, and it has a multiplier effect. So the importance, I guess, of substance abuse treatment as a place where we can intervene. As Scott pointed out, the new infections are in younger people. We're missing the opportunity to educate them and get them before they start injecting drugs, but once they get into substance abuse treatment, there's another opportunity presented to screen people for hepatitis C, to educate them, to do some prevention, and get them vaccinated for hepatitis A and B as well. Unfortunately, we know that in the United States, less than 1/4 of all reporting substance abuse facilities offered hepatitis C screening to their patients. It was much higher among federally funded substance abuse treatment programs, but those federally funded programs the federally funded programs are a very small proportion of all substance abuse treatment facilities. So I think that there's a lot of work that we need to do with privately run substance abuse treatment facilities as well to encourage them and figure out new ways to help them get reimbursed, to incentivize hepatitis C testing in substance abuse treatment facilities. Because one of the priority areas of the Viral Hepatitis Action Plan is to reduce viral hepatitis associated with drug use, to ensure that people have access to the information and the services they need, both by integrating clinical services into drug treatment programs, but also integrating drug treatment into our other medical clinical services. Mobilizing those community resources to promote partnerships between law enforcement, with health departments and community-based organizations to make sure that people can get the education and the comprehensive syringe services programs. And then continue and expand harm reduction, because harm reduction, although we don't have the research that shows that it is as effective with hepatitis C as it has been for HIV, when you combine medication-assisted treatment for hepatitis C along with harm reduction services, we can really make a difference in terms of reducing new infections and hepatitis C. So I've mentioned a number of opportunities to integrate program activities, but I think it's important to note that some of our federal programs have also been supportive of those kinds of integrations. And since Siri mentioned the Office of Minority Health funded program out of the Core Center here in Chicago, SAMHSA permits the use of up to 5% of Minority AIDS Initiative funds for the use of viral hepatitis activities. And CDC permits the use of 5% of its health department HIV FOA dollars to support integrated services, which includes screening for viral hepatitis and STDs and TB. We also know that we have Ryan White and that care program, which can ensure that people who have HIV are tested and then refer them to other prevention services, including screening for viral hepatitis. So, while we were updating the Viral Hepatitis Action Plan, we were really looking at how we can foster the partnerships and the collaboration that we feel, that we know are necessary, because it is clear that the federal government all by itself is not going to be able to lick this hepatitis C problem. We really need the active involvement. We need the creativity and experiences of people in the field who have been doing this and affected and developing effective interventions and programs that really serve people who are at risk for and infected with hepatitis C. So a few of the things that we've done by way of example include a couple of technical consultations, including one on hepatitis C in young people who inject drugs, which we did back in 2013. We did a community stakeholder consultation where we were looking at, you know, getting input from the community. And we continue to look for those kinds of inputs as we implement the Viral Hepatitis Action Plan. And the action plan that we have now goes through 2016. At some point in the very near future, we'll be looking at updating that action plan again. And again, there's an opportunity to provide input and give us your ideas and share your model programs and help us to understand better what it is that's going to be effective in terms of addressing hepatitis C see in the U.S. So we do have a viral hepatitis implementation group. It's a great group, very dedicated experts across the federal government, not just in the Department of Health and Human Services, but Housing and Urban Development, in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and the Veterans Affairs, Veterans Administration? Got that wrong on that slide, sorry about that. But they are doing a fabulous job of taking care of our veterans who have hepatitis C. So I challenge you to think about how you can integrate programs and use that stakeholder workbook, hopefully, to help identify some of the most strategic ways, you know, recognizing that we're all working in a resource-limited settings to be most effective in integrating hepatitis C into the work that you do. So I'm really proud of the work of many of our federal colleagues and partners, because we do have some great resources. The CDC developed a hepatitis risk assessment, which is free online. It takes about 5 minutes, and after answering about 10 questions, the person who completes it will get recommendations based on CDC's recommendations of what hepatitis testing and vaccination are recommended for them, very personalized. CDC is also, all of the top two graphics are new materials from CDC. There are free posters, there are fact sheets that you can print out. They've done a lot of work to increase the number of cool, appealing, fact-based educational materials and posters and fact sheets. Also, our office, we run aids.gov/hepatitis, and we've got some resources for you there as well. SAMHSA has done some work to try to increase capacity among substance abuse treatment programs, and also targeting patients in substance abuse treatment programs. And then the SAMHSA-funded ATTCs, Addiction Technology Transfer Centers, have recently developed a new curriculum and also some materials for people working in substance abuse treatment. Again, that's, you know, an area of great concern for us because of that 150% increase in new hepatitis C infections. So there are more. I couldn't obviously list all of the resources that are available, but we do continue to implement the Viral Hepatitis Action Plan to believe that we can do better through collaboration across federal programs, but also with our health departments and other community partners. And we do remain a nation committed to combating the silent epidemic of viral hepatitis. Thank you.
Thank you, Karina. And now I'd like to open up to questions. In the back. Sure, so I'll just briefly repeat the question for recording purposes. So it's on the lines of, in order to expand screening for hepatitis C, especially in emergency care and inpatient settings, with regard to the national coverage determination by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, how can we get around potential barriers as emergency care was excluded?
So I have heard that. I'm aware. It is, I agree, unfortunate that all settings weren't included. We, frankly, were disappointed that the settings were so limited when CMS came down with their decision. However, I guess what I've heard from EDs that have done some demonstration projects is that the linkage to care for those patients who are tested in the ED has been very difficult, and the linkage to care is, in fact, very low. And so I think that what is needed is at least one program that shows that they can effectively link to care, so that we can take that back to our colleagues at CMS and try to convince them that it is a good investment to do more testing in emergency departments. We try to work closely with the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, but we don't always, it's interesting, across HHS, frankly, we don't always speak the same language. But I do believe that it's possible to get that changed. I will certainly take the message back I know that it can be effective in identifying people, but I think that we need to do a little more work in terms of ensuring that the linkage to care happens, so that we can make sure that folks get paid, reimbursed for that, and those programs become sustainable.
Question was around current challenges and access to hepatologists.
Good question, Diane. Thank you. I think there are about, for those who don't know, there are only about 2,000 board-certified hepatologists in the United States, and many of them, there are a couple thousand more gastroenterologists, but many of these people do not actually work with hepatitis C. They may be more involved with colonic disorders and various things. So that has been a real bottleneck, and what has been going on is that the Infectious Disease Society of America, which is not a huge organization itself, but it's another few thousand people, many of whom have had a lot of experience treating HIV, which, as we know, in the old days was darn hard to treat and take care of patients. So certainly they're capable of doing this work. And so we're getting more and more infectious disease doctors involved in the care, and they qualify as experts as well. But the big thing, I think, is the big group here are the general clinicians out there who, I mean, with very little training, really, these drugs are so great, can certainly follow a patient adequately over a 12-week or hopefully even a 3 or 4 week course and make sure that they get cured and they get taken care of. So there are efforts underway by both professional and general societies to get more treating physicians out there. Because we have, you've got 3 million people, you can't expect 2,000 to do all the treatment. So, did you have a follow-up question?
Well, no, but are you going to call for a question? The literature, I've not seen much on the risk of epidemiology for hepatitis C with
You've got to remember the research, the dollars, and hence the research activity for hepatitis C is such a minuscule fraction of what it is for HIV. And as you know, there's limited data about transgender people and even HIV. So you can imagine there really are, at this point, no data on transgender people. By the way, I don't remember that we think the risk is mainly parenteral, that is by puncture of the skin. It's very, I mean, sexual risk we mainly see in HIV-infected gay men, and that's in the big picture relatively, it's a big problem, but in the big picture it's a small percentage of our problem.
But related to transgender, it may be worth looking at doing some education around injection safety if they're injecting hormones, but as Scott said, there's very little research. I mean, I've never seen any.
Right, just thinking about the HIV, are there therapeutic risks in transgenders being at the top of that list makes one wonder.
It's very likely that there's a greater risk.
Especially elevated risk there as well, and we can learn more. We can pull in some more.
And also in response to the prior question about access to hepatologists, one resource that we recommend is Help for Hep. And that's both a hotline that you can call, anyone can call and talk with experts, and they also have a mobile app. Both have been really helpful, and we have a recent blog post, again, on aids.gov/hepatitis, and you can get additional details about Help for Hep there.
And they have a listing of doctors that, or providers that are treating hepatitis B. So that may help to find new sources of care outside of the hepatology.
Tomorrow I'll going to be presenting this, but I showed that in the data distribution that the only limiting this age group to baby boomers or from age 1935 to 65 does not really cover the majority of the HCV. And actually, if you look at the race differences, I saw that if you move the group to 1950s, 1970s, you cover more whites, and actually the target hits African Americans right, but the distribution is a little wide. So if you extend it like 5 years on all ages, you significantly improve the coverage. I don't know if you know anything about this, like how this goal standard came up.
Sure. So the question is regarding the CDC and U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendations to screen all boomers, and currently boomers is defined as 1945 to 1965. So the question is, does that age cohort include all races and ethnicities appropriately, and how that was designed?
There might be some confusion about this. This isn't either or. In other words, we have always strongly recommended that anyone with a risk factor be treated. So that's anyone with a prior history of injection drug use, anyone with a, with any of the markers that we commonly see, like, you know, tattoos and other risk things. So when CDC set that at 45 to 65, that was set to capture 75% of the people who would actually be infected. Extending it to 1970, I mean, if someone wants to do that, they can. But I mean, we're talking about people focusing on where 75% of our cases are, our chronic cases are. One thing that is not clear is that since we made the recommendations, we're trying now to find out how many more cases of hepatitis C we're detecting by adding this group to the groups that need to be tested for hepatitis C. And that's a little bit iffy right now. We know that there's been more testing. We're not sure whether it's actually finding more cases. So, anyway.
Are there any other questions at this time? Well, hearing none, I wanted to briefly summarize our panel, and if our panelists have any final thoughts or what you'd like the audience to take away, I'll turn to you in just one moment. Again, we really thank you for joining us today. As you've heard, there are many challenges, all of which are very real and complex. There's more people dying of hepatitis C than all other nationally notifiable diseases combined. However, we have more opportunities than ever before, thanks to preventive screenings and other expanded opportunities under the Affordable Care Act. We have the National Viral Hepatitis Action Plan, and we have curative therapies, usually between 90 to 100% cure rates achieved. And many federal tools, as again you saw, and again we invite you to go to aids.gov/hepatitis to access a lot of these resources. And if you go to our federal partners' direct website as well, you can for free download the resources or have them mailed to you. Again, either option is free. And we look forward to working with you. Please do reach out to us. We always would love to hear about ways we can collaborate. And if you are already working in the field of hepatitis C, we are always looking to highlight some best practices and achievements on the blog, again, at aids.gov/hepatitis. And we invite you again to look at our action plan and its companion stakeholders workbook, which is on the APHA website in the online handout section. And that is, we just invite you to join us in continuing to break the silence. So with that, I want to turn back to our panelists if you have a final thought or anything you'd like to share.
Okay. I would just add, one of the things that we generally focus on when we are speaking with persons who are, whether you're working directly in the field in terms of hepatitis or you're working in another area where there's a possibility of infections, or in terms of working within your community, it's something that we refer to as a sphere of influence. Starting first with your individual and your family, your sphere of influence. One of the questions that we often ask after whether it's this presentation or another, hepatitis or HIV or diabetes or looking at weight reduction, for your sphere of influence, what is it that I can do in terms of taking responsibility? What messages can I share with those that are closest with me, your family members and others within that individual, that more personal circle? Secondly, in that sphere, we ask, what is it that you can do within your network? That is, the network within your community, your associations with civic organizations, where you may volunteer, perhaps where you work, or with other relationships with persons that you may engage with other partnerships, whether that is a salon that you actually attend, or perhaps with other parents or other friends within your network, and sharing this information about hepatitis, because it is very important that would increase the awareness, that would increase the number of persons who are screened, and those that are actually tested, that actually receive the results from the confirmatory test. And then lastly, that is the professional networks in terms of your sphere of influence. We have a lot of influence where we work with those that we work with, whether this is actually integrating, as it's possible, integrating HCV screening, integrating or leveraging the resources so that you can share this information. One of the resounding messages that we heard over and over again from the leaders from the forum meeting that was held in March of this year is, how do we go about integrating this message? Because I may have a chapter meeting, whether that's with a Greek organization that I'm a member of, or perhaps a professional association, or perhaps a PTA meeting. We have spheres of influence that are close to us, the individual and family. Secondly, our social, our civic organizations, our community organizations that we interact with. And third, looking very closely at that professional resources, your network, and how we can either leverage existing resources to be able to influence and shape messages so that we can get the word out, increase awareness, increase the number of persons who are screened, and increase the number of persons who actually receive the screening and the testing and receive the confirmatory results. So with that, I'd like to say thank you.
Yeah, so thanks again to all of you for joining us today, and please join me in thanking our federal panel.